Accession number 12268, Mr. Charles Biedemann, reel 7.
Biedemann, reel 7. Yes, you're going to tell me about the atomic bomb now, aren't you, Charles? You know, when were you first aware that a bomb of this nature had been dropped?
Well, what happened there was working on a market garden. And there's a market garden that they'd acquired, which was about something like 10 acres, I suppose. When there wasn't enough signals to camp, then we were out working on this garden, which I personally quite enjoyed, because I've always been quite fond of gardening. And we'd grow lots of things there. Pumpkins used to grow easily because they could go up the hillside, etc. And we were also able to make ourselves vegetable soup during the midday break. So that was worthwhile. In the early afternoon, suddenly a cloud appeared in the sky. A white cloud. There were all sorts of conjectures as to what this was, because very shortly after this, they stopped us working and had us come back to camp. And I remember it as a particularly sunny afternoon. And on the way back to the camp, we heard a broadcast. And they told us this was the Emperor speaking to his people. I didn't know then, but this was the first time he'd ever spoken to his people. So all work had stopped everywhere, and we got back to the camp. Then the rumours became rife as to what this cloud was. Some people thought that it was camouflage, you know, the Air Force had produced some sort of cloud to disappear into. That seemed nonsense to me, because a cloud in a cloudless sky was obviously very conspicuous. Some people thought it was mustard gas, because the guards told them that there's the Americans had been dropping something which burnt. And so immediately people thought about mustard gas. Again, I thought myself that this probably wasn't possible, because it was very late in the war, and why should they suddenly use gas? And then, I suppose, within a day or so, we learnt that it was an atomic bomb. They dropped this on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Did that mean anything to you then? You know, an atomic bomb. Did you know the nature of this?
Oh, did you
realise?
Oh, yes. I mean, because these have been around for, I think, for some little while. We didn't realise how devastating they could be. It also sort of filtered through to us that although the Emperor spoke to people and stopped the war, Tojo and his ministers wanted to continue, because it wasn't in Japanese mentality at all to surrender. But the mere fact that it was the Emperor himself that stopped it, it sort of held the thing, you know, sort of held it together, and it stopped. There seemed to be very little animosity towards us. We gradually took over the town, which is amazing, because we only had 300 or so in the camp. We took it over to the extent that some Americans, you know, went into a bank and demanded some money. And they gave them some script yen, which is Philippine yen, which is really worthless. They brought this back to camp, and we told them this is worthless. So they went back the next day and told them to change this yen into Japanese yen. So we had masses of money. You know. And if anybody wanted to go out for the evening, they could help themselves and just take the money. Not that there was anything you could do, because there were a few places where you could drink beer, and the shops had practically nothing at all in them. So the thing wasn't there. the camp took over a brewery. Somebody discovered where the brewery was, and they got all the volunteers they wanted, you know, to assist them loading up trucks. And again, even trucks weren't easy to come by because they were in short supply. And so we did have beer. And then American planes were buzzing around. In those days, there were B-29s. And they had no idea where we were. So it was pretty frustrating for us to see all this stuff coming across, and they just couldn't see us at all because we were in sort of almost a valley, you know, surrounded with mountains. And one day I had an idea and collected a fatigue squad, and we had lots of roof tiles. There were big tiles, black tiles that they used. So I had them take them down to a square below us, because this YMCA building, I think I said before, was on top of a hill. And there's this big open square they just used for parades, and we made a large PW by putting three of these tiles wide. And I would think possibly about 60 yards long. And then somebody discovered some paint, some orange paint, and we painted the centre tile orange. And this is, it sounds too coincidental to be correct, but it is absolutely accurate. I mean, no sooner put the last brush of paint on this PW sign when one of these American planes saw us and waggled its wings. And then they came back the next day, quite a squadron of them. And a B-29, even in those days, held tons, probably 10 tons. And they dropped all the food you could think of. But that itself was highly dangerous, because if you get a crate bursting in midair and it's got hundreds of tins of, say, pineapple, you can just as easily be killed with a tin of pineapple as anything else. And you've got no idea where they were coming. And, in fact, I think I've still got a note that I collected when they were delivering all these goods to us. And this is dated September the 8th, 1945, and reads, "Hope you fellows are out in quick time. Good luck." And it's signed by several people. There's a son, Richard Limburger, and an Albert Barker, and a Dummer, and Lieutenant Young, and the Staff Sergeant Hart, the Troop Sergeant Rowland, and Flying Officer Harrington, and the First Lieutenant Henyatun, and Sergeant Mountenay, and all of 40th Bomb Squadron, 6th Group, APO 336, OZOP, MSF, California, an air crew and ground crew of the One Wing Low.
Were there any reprisals taken by the POWs, you know, against the Japanese?
No.
What actually happened to the guards and the...
Most of them took off. Yes.
The guards, whether you attempted to lock them up or anything.
Yes. We found that most of the guards took off after a couple of days. Found that most of the guards took off after a couple of days. An American friend of mine often said to me during our captivity, "When this is over, I could stick a bayonet into any Japanese without turning a hair." When, in fact, the war was over, and after a few days we were down at a dockside and there were batches of Japanese soldiers, I suddenly saw Jerry Foley handing out cigarettes to these Japanese, and I said to him, "I'm waiting to see the bayonet come into action." And he said, "Well," he said, "you know what it's like being without a cigarette." So the attitudes changed very rapidly. There was only one sort of reprisal we did take, and that was against an American warrant officer, naval warrant officer, and he had liaised far too freely with the Japanese, and we felt that he was responsible for some of our miseries. So we did send a report through to the American naval authorities. How far it got from there, I just wouldn't know. But outside this, I didn't see anything. And in fact, in one or two of the nicer guards tried to be as pleasant as they could to us and stayed around to be as helpful as they could. Another interesting thing was, having dropped all these massive supplies, the first issue of cigarettes we had was 2,000 per man, because as I said, we were just a small camp, and as matches it were ad lib. And when they tried to ration, our own officers tried to ration the men sensibly, I mean, they would have none of it. And some of them said, you know, we're just meat hungry, so we just let them sort of let them loose, let them eat whatever they wanted to. And none of them came to any particular harm. And on one occasion, we had a truck and some parachutes had landed some distance away. We went there, and the particular crates contained chocolate bars. So I suppose in all there probably was, well, at least half a ton of chocolate bars. And we were surrounded by Japanese children. So I think it was me who decided that we'd offer some of these to Japanese children, which we did. And then within minutes, wished we hadn't, because there were hundreds of children arrived. The Japanese were shouting because they hadn't tasted chocolate in years. And this is their sort of wildest dreams come true. And we really had to fight our way out, you know, to get back with all this. The Japanese girls and women were very keen about the parachutes because, again, I mean, material was in short supply. And they liked red particular because this is they like this for their children's kimonos and things like this. So there was a ready sale for that. Not that I ever sold them, but the general policy in the camp was to save the parachutes and return to the authorities. But the men had different ideas, and any time they wanted to go out, they'd stuff a parachute into a haversack and go out and could sell this just like that for almost anything they wanted. It just went through. Another little amusing episode was when this first lot of supplies dropped, it so happened that the first parachutes that dropped on our camp itself, because we were very close to the parade ground, were red, white and blue. And I remember a Dutchman sort of jumping up and down and saying, you know, it's the Dutch national colours. Well, I can remember thinking to myself, but I didn't say anything, that they're equally the French national colours and the British national colours. And I'm certain that there were several men on the roof and jumped up and down. They were leaving feet off the roof. They were so excited. They went through there.
This camp, from what you've been saying, was obviously mixed nationalities. Is that right?
Yes, because we were dealing with the sick men off convoys. You know, and the Dutch people who came from Java, and we had one who was Belgian. I don't quite know how he got in, but he must have been in Java somewhere or the other. And then there were Americans, and we had a few Canadians, and even one or two Australians. And the bulk of it, I think, was Javanese, sort of either real Javanese or half-caste Javanese.
Again, like the camp in Java, did the officers and the men, were they all mixed up?
Yes. There's virtually no distinction. They had the same sleeping quarters. They had the same food. The only distinction was if it was on a working party, an officer would lead the party out or be in charge of the party. That was the only distinction.
But he would work, would he?
Just the same. Yes, been no difference at all.
Did you get any pay for the work you did?
Yes, very minimal, and it could often be months in retard. I can't quite remember how much it was. It was sort of something like shillings per month, and there wasn't much you could buy with it anyway. And they used to give us about 3 cigarettes a month. Another lesson it taught me there was that if a man cuts a cigarette in 3 and gives you one part of it, he's being very generous. When we came back home, and if anybody offered you a cigarette, it was just a social gesture. It meant nothing more than that. So I think it taught me a lot more about human nature, about some of the realities and discernments. And I can remember thinking to myself, if I survive this lot, these will be bonus years, so I should just enjoy my life and try not to hurt people more than I can, but definitely look upon them as bonus years, and equally, nothing is ever going to bother me again, because after Japan, what else could measure up to it? So in a sense, you live down as low as it's possible for a human being to live and survive. And if once you survive that, you ought to be a better person, which doesn't mean to say that I don't grumble or I don't get cross, because I can. But if I do get myself into odd situations which are not comfortable, I've only got to think back to Japan, and by contrast, and nothing. You know.
It was interesting what you were saying earlier on, your reaction to the atomic bomb. You know, the fact that it's, you indicated that you felt it saved your life.
Yes.
So would you justify the dropping of that bomb then, Charles?
Yes. I've always had, personally, a lot of regard for Truman. I think he was a good, realistic president. And irrespective of saving prisoners of war's lives, I think he also saved Japanese lives, as well as his own service people, because he brought the war to a sudden halt, and it finished it. In Nagasaki, they didn't drop this on census population at all. They dropped it on the Mitsubishi factory, which I think was about 6 or 7 miles outside of Nagasaki itself, and they destroyed the factory and everything else around completely. In fact, we came through, I suppose, about a month after they dropped the bomb, and we came into this area by train very slowly, because the rails had gone, so they had to put in fresh ones, and there was an area 4 square miles devastated. And I still remember they were all sort of, everything was reddish brown. It had just been burnt. The main factory was a big one. All the girls were like tinsel, and the concrete chimneys had double S bends in them. And I met somebody in my own regiment who was on work in Nagasaki on one of the big ship cranes, and this was toppled into the water, and that was something like 7 miles from the epicenter. And I thought to myself, well, I'd seen landmines back home, which were something like a ton. And this was too vast, and I thought this was going to finish war, because it was too vast to contemplate. And I suppose today they're thousands of times stronger. So, atomic war just can't make sense at all. Hiroshima I never saw. We just heard about it. But there all sorts of strange rumours crept up, like there was nothing would grow for 75 years. In actual fact, the harvest next year was one of the best they ever had. It's of interest, too, that it came through one of my great friends died quite young, in his very early 40s, of leukemia. But I myself, outside of a little bit of skin manifestation, have had no troubles at all. So, once again, I think our knowledge on the atomic bomb and its effects is a bit limited. And I suppose it will remain limited. At least I hope so.
Did you find... you've explained how contemptuous the Japanese were towards you for being prisoners. Mm. And what valiant fighters they were, how determined. Mm. What was their attitude when they knew they had lost the war?
The Japanese I spoke to, they said to me that, I think the word is Vokoyan, the Americans, just too clever. They could fight normal things, but they couldn't fight this. This was too much. And also, the Japanese had a lot of regard for the Americans. There's a lot of Americanization in Japan. And they love baseball. They like the American way of life. And they also like General MacArthur a great deal, because he was an emperor figure. And he actually fitted in. He liked the Japanese, and the Japanese liked him. So he set the seal of a lot of their success, because he simply took over from the emperor that was there. There was a sort of godlike figure to them.
From what you saw, you were saying these planes flew over in September, judging by the date on your note, and then your journey through Nagasaki to presumably on your way home. What were your sort of impressions of the nature of the occupation, the American occupation of Japan, in that brief time you were there?
I didn't see it, merely. When the war was over, we, in our camp, commandeered two cars. They were both Buicks. Now, you had to be an admiral or general in Japan to have a car. So we had these, and we were using it just to go to nearby camps, like Shimonoseki, and swap medical supplies, etc., or anything we wanted. This only happened for a few weeks. And I finally took the last lot of our sick men through to the station, because we were going by train to Nagasaki. Came out of this Buick car, shut the door, and left it. And it was only about a month later I thought to myself, I must have left a great fortune behind, because there were just no cars around. You know, somebody must have taken it. But, because it meant nothing. Equally, the money that we had, which amounted to tens of thousands of yen, again meant nothing, because we couldn't buy anything with it. And when we got to Nagasaki, the American fleet had just come in. See, they really hadn't sort of occupied anything at all. And they clustered around us and asked us if we had any money, because they want to go in town. And so we were all of us just dishing out these 100 yen and 1,000 yen, just like that, just pushing them out, because it meant nothing to us, When we came back to England, the government would have changed to 1/7 a yen, because they're probably quid, large amounts of them down. But because we had the get a small amount of pay, I think I actually came back with something like about 60 yen or something, nothing very much. But when you get in these large amounts, it just is meaningless, and unless you're very avaricious concerned about it. And before I left Moji, this lady who sort of befriended me and looked after me, she gave me a kimono with a house crest on it. Beautiful silk too, and also a Japanese doll, which was dressed up in kimono, which I gave to my current girlfriend. No, I didn't. I gave the Japanese doll to an American nurse, because there was no way I could take this very large, heavy crate, which I had made specially too, on a plane. And I kept the kimono, which went to my girlfriend.
How did your, once the war ended and you were sort of free of the camp and then starting to get this food from the Americans and medicines, how quickly would you say did the health improve of the POWs?
It's quite interesting. I mean, we had no means, we did have means of weighing stuff, but I can't remember anybody that did that. So there was a weighing machine in the medical inspection room. An interesting thing was that after a day or so, when the men got fed, their conversation changed. Because up to then, everybody thought about food, about all the savoury foods and the sweet foods and the food they liked. Then after they fed, it was forgotten. And it went straight back to women. The priorities had changed. Before that, you never heard a mention of girls or women or anything like that. But once they were fed, they were changed, gone. I can remember, thinking about that, and grinning to myself.
So was anything done about this? I wondered about the Japanese women.
No.
Was there no relationship there?
I don't think so. I think the Japanese people would have been scared themselves. They're not at all inhibited about sex, the Japanese, I mean, they're sheer sort of communal bars, just like that, even to this day, if you go to a Japanese hotel, proper Mikoyan, they just jump into a communal bath. I mean, they'll put a towel over their heads and that type of thing, but they're not inhibited at all. At the same time, they probably would be scared, it'd be something sort of quite unknown to them. I think there's a lot of fraternisation with the Americans once they got established. As I tell you, they were very scared the Russians were going to come in when it came to them, and they didn't. They're fairly sort of interested people, and I think Japanese would be polite to foreigners, but won't accept them. They're sort of a bit more insular than the French. Some years ago, I was in Japan, and there's a young chap I knew who was married to a Japanese lass. She was a purser in the Japanese Airlines, and her family were farmers. And I was with a crowd of people, and one of them who'd lived out east for a long time, some of the P&O shipping lines, and he said to him, "How'd you get on with your in-laws?" And he said, "Well, very well, So always have sort of quite pleasant relationship. But he said, "They'll be polite to you," he said, "but you'll never become Japanese." Well, it's a bit difficult, but that's basically their attitude, But outside that, they're quite easy. But I didn't hear of anybody who went out. No. I'm trying to think of this. I think I did actually hear of a few men who sort of had a relationship with Japanese girls, because one of them came up to me and asked me for some DDT. And I said, "Well, what on earth do you want DDT for?" And he said, "These Japanese girls," he said, "but you're not sure, the state of health is like." And so I said, "Well, by God, I haven't heard of anybody using DDT on humans. I'm not so sure the results would be." I think if they fund them, and it's of interest too, that if you take the general entertainers, I've forgotten their name now.
The geishas.
Geishas, that's right. The geisha will go with the man if she likes him. And if she doesn't, there's no compulsion for her to have any relationship with them at all. Although, I mean, as far as they're concerned, it's commercial, it's a business, and they're there as entertainers.
While you were in Japan, did the POWs, did you have any assistance from any of the Allied authorities checking up on your health, your psychological state?
No, because they didn't even know where we were.
Was there no authority to sort of gather POWs together?
No. Because, I mean, the Japanese had their own records, but they hadn't released these records to anybody. And even though these Americans dropped these supplies, they knew that somewhere in this district there was a camp there. But that was about as far as they went. Otherwise, they had to sort of pinpoint them. And another interesting thing was that when this was happening, a lot of the men in our camp took off, went to Tokyo.